and welcome. It's another Books of the Year podcast from your friends at Books of the Year, which is a podcast. Matt is looking particularly smart.
It's clear I never, ever wear shirts. So no. Whenever I wear a shirt, then clearly something's happening. So I'm wearing a shirt.
What's afoot?
So something's afoot, isn't
yes.
it? It's clearly, because otherwise, why would I be wearing a shirt?
What's the answer?
Details whenever. Soon, hopefully. Right, let's crack on.
Oh, I see. Now that, can I just say, is someone who is, I think the word is dissembling.
Is a deflection of the highest magnitude there from
yes.
me.
You can get in touch, obviously.
Yes.
Is that what you're trying to
speculate
say?
Speculate on why I'm wearing a shirt. What I should do, obviously, if I had any nous, is I should wear shirts more often.
Yeah.
And then throw people off the scent when I wear a shirt.
It would be a disguise.
It would be, yeah. So basically, Matt, if you were smarter, then no one would know.
Well, there'd be a photograph somewhere of you attending an event.
An event.
Is yeah. sherry going to be poured?
Is there gonna be, no sherry. Not if I have anything to do with it.
Mark in North Nottinghamshire. That's his description.
Yeah.
You wrote to booksoftheyear@yahoo.com because that is, I understand, how you can...
It's one of the many ways you can get in contact with us, yes.
You can always just call in and say hi if you want
yeah.
to go around to Matt's house.
Yes, do. And if you've got a tie, you'll get in. So,
Mark in Bishopsthorpe. Oh, there we go, Bishopsthorpe. Thank you, Mark. Or is that his surname?
No, I'm going to say that's Mark in Bishopsthorpe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hello, Simon. Hello, Matt. Just a quick note to say how much I continue to enjoy your podcast.
Continue. Nice word, yeah.
I'll always have my favourite authors, Stephen King, Michael Connelly, William Boyd, but have discovered so many great authors, thank you, thanks to your recommendations. I've recently enjoyed Damascus Station, David McCloskey, who I still don't believe because he was way too
good-looking. Far too
good-looking,
at
3
wasn't
in the morning.
He? Yeah, yeah.
And the brilliant S.A. Cosby novel, All the Sinners Bleed, two books which I would not have come across had it not been for you. Keep up the good work.
Yes, and those are two books that I'd definitely say those are among my favourites that we've done this year. So those are two very good choices. Siobhan writes, "Hi there. I just heard Louise Doughty authoritatively declare that baby puffins are called puffettes.
Mm.
They are not. They are actually called pufflings."
Which is a much better word.
It definitely, yes. I'm sure you've received an abundance
yes.
of correspondence on this subject. Love the show, Steve. Siobhan.
Pufflings. That sounds... The puffettes does sound like a backing
it's
vocal
yes. Please
girls
welcome.
Group from the
1960s. Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
Pufflings just sounds...
That makes more
cute.
Sense, doesn't it?
Rachel says, at about 5:50 on a weekday evening, listening to a certain radio station, who I often find myself stopping and shaking my head in disagreement with, Matt's confessions verdict.
Mm-hmm.
This is on our radio show, Drive Time at Greatest Hits Radio.
That is true, yes. Yeah.
On the podcast, it's a different story. Earlier this year and recently on your Books of the Year, the story so far episode, Matt raved about Damascus Station to the point that I felt I had to find out what all the fuss was about.
Uh-huh.
After reading the book, I was left with a bereft feeling. Is there a name for this? I actually think that there is, because I think... I have mentioned this before. I think I looked it up, that there is a word.
I remember
for that feeling as you get towards the end of the book and you're slowing down because you don't want it to stop.
Do you know what? I think it was Colson Whitehead's book that you said that about, Underground Railroad.
Underground Railroad. That could,
yeah,
well,
yeah,
that
yeah.
could well be the case. Anyway, and now it's happened again, says Rachel. I listened to you both and Louise Doughty with Matt once more raving about her new novel, A Bird in Winter. And I'm absolutely loving it. In fact, I'm trying to ration my reading of it because I fear that bereft feeling is approaching. So unlike Confessions, I am definitely in agreement with
Aha.
Matt when it comes to books. And wanted to say thank you for encouraging me to choose books that I would previously have left on the shelf. P.S. Damascus Station and Colditz are currently bobbing around in a boat close to Gritviken in South Georgia. I bought both for my husband to take on a long army expedition, and before they went out of communication, planned, not anything scary, he said that there was always a queue amongst the expedition members to read both books after him. So a double win for Books of the Year. Oh, right, that'll be the Ben McIntyre Colditz.
Yes,
yes, of course.
That's a great
yes.
book, that was, as well.
So if you want to get in touch and praise us in any way, how
yes,
can we do that?
You email. I am absolutely hanging on to email as a means of communication. I know everyone, all the kids have moved off it, but I still love the emails. So you can do that on booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. We're still on Twitter whilst the flames climb higher
yes.
in X.
And until he says you've got to pay money, in which case we're out of there.
Everyone's gone then. Unlucky Elon, what kind of a gamble was that? Oh, there goes all your money. At Books of the Year on Twitter / X. And we're also on Instagram and Threads. You're far more prevalent on Threads, aren't
I
you?
I thread to a small but significant... I like
a select.
Yes, I think they're movers and shakers. There are the masses.
Yes.
Who are the unwashed, who are on Twitter. And then there's the, I don't know, I think they're the... I don't know what's the right... The intelligentsia.
There's a great line in This Is Spinal Tap where the manager is asked about why it is that the crowds at Spinal Tap's gigs have got smaller. And he says, I think the audience have just become more exclusive.
Yes.
And that's very
definitely
much how
what
feel.
It is. Anyway, and Instagram and Threads, we're at Pick Any Page, aren't we? That kind of...
Indeed we are. Yes. Yeah.
Let's talk with our best-selling author guest this week, who is Victoria Hislop. And Victoria Hislop is. We'll have done a big preamble, by the way, before.
Oh,
we don't
you?
Just normally start like
okay.
this.
You know, it's a huge, huge build-up for you, by the way.
Oh, how thrilling.
I thought it sounded unnecessarily brusque. Anyway, Victoria Hislop is with us. The Figurine is the name of her latest novel. Matt will now describe the cover.
Here is a cover that shouts out summer, doesn't it? So it blue, the azure blue of, is it the Aegean? Am I getting that
it
right?
Is it is the Aegean. The Aegean.
Stretches out in front of us with some islands in the distance. But basically the front cover is dominated by a figurine, which is apt because that's the title of the book, The Figurine. And then right nestled at the bottom, we've got some domes of a, and I'm now searching, I'm going to say it's a Greek church.
It is. It's a Cycladic church.
A Cycladic church.
Cycladic church, yes.
And we can just make out a little boat floating on the Aegean. The number one best-selling author, Victoria Hislop in gold and The Figurine in white. And Hislop's passionate love of Greece breathes from every page, so says the Daily Mail.
And I'm 100% convinced that that is Santorini.
You're correct, Simon.
Because if you've been to Santorini, you never forget.
Stop.
And then you suddenly notice that almost every photograph you ever see of the Greek islands is a Santorini.
It is
precisely,
iconic.
Precisely, because of reasons like this. And just inside, you get another version of the photograph, like over two pages. And you just think, I'm going to have to go there.
I've always wondered why we use the word blue for quite a negative emotion. I'm feeling blue. I mean, blue makes me feel extraordinarily happy.
And particularly this kind of blue, which
and
these are the and the reason so we're looking at, the reason it's so memorable is because Santorini is famously a volcano which blew its top
absolutely.
Thousands of years ago, and the volcanic bit is sort of off where in the direction that we're looking, isn't it?
It is. It's submerged. I mean, Santorini is a phenomenal place to visit from a sort of geological and seismological point of view. The novel's not actually set there. Unusually, I've made up some islands of my own in this novel, which I always forget to say, and then people send me notes saying, I really want to go to Amos next year, but I can't find it in the brochures. And I think, oh, Taurus, so sorry, I forgot to tell you. I've fictionalised three different islands just to give myself a bit more sort of artistic licence this time.
So it's easier to make up an island than...
Yes, in some ways. I didn't want people to feel that I was being specific about a particular place this time, because I've visited now 50 islands altogether, and that's a very small number compared with the number of inhabited islands there are in Greece. But I've this year visited my 50th, and there were so many small elements from different ones that I wanted to introduce.
Which is there's nothing to do with it. Which is your favourite island so far?
Well, my favourite still is Crete, which is such a big island that it's almost a little country, but it is an island. And that's where I have a house and spend a lot of time. So it's the one I know best, and I never, ever get to the end of my discoveries there. So
now, when Matt was describing the cover, and you were talking about a Cycladic church, and we talked about the figurine, can you just introduce us to what Cycladic art is and the figurine... which we have on the front of the book and is the title of the book. Can you just describe what we're looking at?
Yeah, well, the Cycladic Islands are named after the Greek word for Kyklos, just to add some kind of ancient and modern Greek here, which means circle. And they actually form a circle around a tiny island called Delos, which was a very revered sanctuary, supposedly the birthplace of Apollo and Artemis. So that's why the Cyclades are called the Cycladic Islands, because they form a circle. And in that whole region, on many islands, have been found these very petite, usually about 9 inches long, little statuettes of women predominantly. 95% of these little tiny figurines are female, and they're very mysterious. They're dated back to around 5,000 years ago, so the early Bronze Age, and they're generally found in graves. So nobody really, that's a wonderful thing about them for me, is these figurines are quite mysterious. And that's something that always attracts me, because no one will ever really know what they were for. And thousands of them have been found. And most of them lay buried for all these thousands of years. And once the archaeologists began to find them, they were recognised by modern artists such as Picasso and Modigliani, not only as something very beautiful, but as also inspiration for this kind of very naive, simple kind of art that really attracted them. So if you look at any Henry Moore or a Picasso or a Modigliani, you'll see something that actually resembles something from 5,000 years ago. And I find these small, I think of them as small women, these very slim-lined, sort of supermodel women made out of marble, sculpted thousands of years ago, and I find them very beautiful. So, unfortunately, a lot of other people do. So, from time to time, they come up in auction, and the record for one was $16 million. Wow. So they became very valuable and therefore very stealable. So there's a whole story of their sort of beauty and their mystery and their importance to this ancient civilization, and at the same time their potential for theft and being smuggled, which is a big international story because it connects with people smuggling and drug smuggling and gun smuggling, and all of these things kind of intertwine and make a lot of money for criminals. So we have something very beautiful at the centre of the story, but she is sort of representative of a trade in illegal goods. So yes, in a nutshell, the little statuette has caused a lot of trouble.
So the figurine is one star, and the other star is Helena, who's the woman that we follow through. Just introduce us to her and how she takes us into this story.
Well, Helena is the protagonist, and she is half Scottish, but half Greek. And this, we meet her first as a little girl, 8 years old, and she goes to visit her grandparents in Athens for the first time. And this is during the 1960s, when the military junta has taken over. And that was a period of real darkness in modern Greek history. Three colonels took over the country and essentially ruled it for 7 years with a rod of iron. So if you were a writer, an artist, a socialist, a left-wing activist, you were either exiled or sent to prison. So this innocent little girl, Helena, goes to visit for the very first time, and through her kind of naive gaze, you... Obviously, at the beginning, it looks very idyllic. Blue skies, she's taken to the seaside, she eats ice cream and is in a very luxurious flat. But she begins to notice things about her grandfather, which suggest there is a whole other side to this wonderful country that she's come to visit. And gradually she discovers his connection with the thefts of antiquities.
And that really forms the context of that sort of opening to the book, is her experiences with her grandfather and grandmother there. I want to ask you about that very context, because I hadn't read a book that was set in that time in Greece before. And at one point, I can't remember who it is, but one of the characters, I think it might be Elena, says the English had a civil war and it was all over in 9 years. And yet there are ripples still being felt of this. And it reminded me when we had Robert Harris come on the podcast to talk about Act of Oblivion, which was this idea that everything's going to be forgotten, apart from the people who signed the death warrant for Charles I, everything else is forgotten. And it got me thinking about the different ways different countries have of dealing with a civil war, dealing with a rift, because Spain's had it, South Africa's had it, America's had it, England's had it. The different ways nations deal with it. How do you think Greece has dealt with it? And do you still see those ripples being felt now?
Well, for sure, the 20th century in Greece was an extraordinarily turbulent period. The early 20th century saw this huge exchange of populations, which was when 1.5 million refugees came in from Turkey in the early 20s to a country that only had 5 million people. So they suddenly had another 25%. So there was that to deal with. Then they had a military dictatorship. Then they had occupation. And then they had a very brutal civil war. After that, from the sort of 50s into the early 60s, things relatively calm for Greece. And then another military dictatorship. So they've had something almost every 10 to 12, 15 years that has turned the country upside down. And politically, they still have a communist party, for example. They still have a really proper, in Greece, capital K, communist party. And then they have a very far right extreme still, Golden Dawn, who were made illegal a couple of years ago, but are gradually creeping in under another name. So politics in Greece, that's how you know that there have been all these splits, because they seem very incapable of even holding a single party together. As soon as you have a new political party, which happens every few years, that splits. They're very good at arguing and not very good at finding, they find a modus operandi, but they're never really happy with it. Even if there's because I now vote in Greece, I have full democratic rights as a sort of Greek citizen. So I have to find out who to vote for. So I read up on all these parties, and when you get to vote, there are 40 or 50 on the list. I mean, it's quite absurd in my sort of old British eyes. But the current party, Nea Dimokratia, they got an overwhelming majority. And yet the very next day, everyone's arguing fiercely. And you think, well, somebody voted for these people. So the Greeks muddle along. How they deal with the aftermath of these big splits, the civil war was a huge split, the dictatorship created a huge split, is that they almost then go back to a normality, and on an individual basis, they live for now. They go back to living for today. And I think that's how they cope with it. They don't think too much about the past. They're not still talking about this dictatorship. They don't talk about the civil war. And then when I bring a book out in Greece, always a few people get very, really cross with me. They say, why are you bringing up our civil war? It's too early, they said, with
too
my
early, really.
Previous book. Too early to talk about the civil war. I said, well, how long ago was that then? They said, 70 years. I think that's probably a good time.
But it's the same in Spain when when their civil war comes up, maybe through a film or through a novel. Everything is open again, and the sides are arguing again, and it's clear that there's, Franco only disappeared in the 70s.
There.
Those wounds are passed on from generation to generation.
Absolutely, the wounds are, I think. But on the other hand, in their style of living for today, which is very much the Greek style of living. You know, you have money today, you spend it today. It suits them to have a sort of mostly to forget and to move on, but still to argue vociferously in the cafe.
Fine.
You know, they do a lot of arguing in the cafe neon, and that's what cafe neons are for. If you've ever been to Greece, they're full of people, you know, banging the table. You think they're going to come to blows, but they're the oldest friends from, you know, 50, 60 years. They argue, then they shake hands, clink their raki glasses together and go home.
So broaden the family out. So we're with Helena in the 60s and as a child with childlike eyes, and, you know, although she's still aware that her grandfather is a difficult character, and we are kind of thinking, okay, this guy's a bastard. So we've learnt that. So just introduced to the wider family, mm-hmm. And also, is it Arsenis or Arsenis?
Arsenis.
Arsenis. There you go. I was gonna.
Sounds like arsenic. My names are usually quite indicative of the character of the person. So
okay.
Yes.
So just introduced to the broader family, because it's the ripples of that certainly go through your story.
Yeah. So Helena's grandmother, Eleni, after whom she's actually named, is a very kind, ostensibly very kind and sweet woman. But she has been almost married to, in some kind of arrangement, to this older man who is Papayannis, and he's a general in the army. I mean, Helena is at 8 years old, completely uninterested in politics, as most eight-year-olds are. But she sees that this grandfather figure has a really dominant position in the family, and, you know, which is so different from her parents. She's come from really quite an idyllic family background, where she's sort of totally adored by two parents, and this uncle figure, who is actually the nephew of her grandfather, a sort of rather creepy man who sort of is clearly very close to her grandfather. So nothing is out in the open in this household. And then there's the maid, Dina, who is a character who I could actually have written a whole novel about, but she is one of these young women who's been recruited from the countryside, something that happened very often in Greece at that time, because this is the 50s in Greece were extremely poverty stricken, and a young woman could come as a maid into a family in Greece, in Athens, for a pittance. And this particular woman, Dina, is only recruited because her family is very right wing, so there's a sort of connection with the right wing kind of aspect of this Papayannis, the grandfather's life. So again, Helena, very naive, but little by little discovers that her mother basically left Greece in protest at her father's actions, this sort of brutal general, because she has seen, you know, what his politics are. And her best friend suffers at the hands of her own father. So without giving away the sort of plot of the novel too much, this is Helena finds herself in the middle of a kind of quite a politically extreme family. And that's not at all something she feels comfortable with. And then as she becomes a teenager, she sort of is able to take some action to make some kind of recompense for what her grandfather has done.
I just want to take us back to what we were talking about right at the start, which is this the smuggling of antiquities out of Greece, because early on in the book, it's there in the shadows. We don't really talk about it that much at the start, but as we go further into the book, there's one instance where a character literally leaves an island with a suitcase full of Lord knows what, and I got the sense from that we've moved from the 60s into the 70s, and I got the sense that was there a time when it was at its worst. In other words, where people were descending on these islands and just digging it up out of the ground, and I'll have that, and I'll fill my bag with it, and then I'll be off to sell it. Is it still going on now, or was there a really particularly bad time?
Well, unfortunately, I think it still is going on. It happened, I think, more in the 60s and 70s, because it was much easier then to sell. There weren't as many restrictions. And now there are, there's a UN, UNESCO agreement that things that are found since 1970 have to be declared and certified that it's permissible to take them out of the country. So there is much stricter legislation now. But the 60s and probably the end of the 50s, which again were very impoverished times on these islands, where people did literally live hand to mouth. So there was a trade, and local people would know that they would, somebody would come and offer them lots of money, and they wouldn't say no. Very unlikely for them to say no if they were going to be given, you know, to feed their family. You know, it was literally as basic as that. And the same in Italy, where it was done on a really industrial scale. Because if a tomb robber knew that there was a tomb, that there was treasure inside, it might not even be known to the archaeological authorities that that tomb existed, so they could literally, you know, secretively discover, you know, find these things, bring them out and sell them. And there's been a huge market, and a lot of these things disappeared into private collections, so they're very hard to track down, because you don't, if you don't know they're there in the first place, but there are people who are very keen to have them on their shelves in their, you know, quite often in New York, in their apartments. It's hard to track down something that you don't even know is there. But gradually, these collectors have become, you know, more aware of the morality of what they have, and they either give them to museums or they sell them back to museums. So we are kind of getting a lot of these things back. But in the case of the figurine, a lot of these, and in pieces, were discovered on a particular island called Keros. And I was very lucky to go on an excavation there and to the next door island to it. And so it was explained to me by this wonderful man, Colin Renfrew, who's a Cambridge professor, that when he first visited the island, he could see, because he's an extraordinarily clever man, he could see a whole area on this island that had been already dug, and he could see that. And eventually those pieces turned up in a collection in America, and a lot of them have found their way back to Greece. So he knew that his work in some way could never be absolutely complete. He couldn't really complete his jigsaw because pieces were already missing. So it is a kind of cloak and dagger story. And there are various experts in stolen antiquities who are academics who track these things down.
Have you held a figurine in your hand?
No, I haven't. And I'm not sure I would like to, because of the responsibility. I think my hands would be shaking so much that there would be a danger of dropping. But I've obviously seen them, and the Cycladic Art Museum in Athens has this beautiful collection, and you know, you can get very close, but they're behind glass. But something worth $16 million, I don't think I'd want to hold it.
I suppose it gets to the heart of a very contemporary conversation, which is not just where do we belong, but where does a thing belong? You know, an item from history. Museums, by their very nature, are full of bits and pieces. Some of them are from this country, but particularly in the UK, obviously they've been borrowed, bought, taken, stolen, looted, whatever, you know, and everything is different, you know. But this goes to the heart of a very contemporary conversation.
It does.
George Osborne is in charge of the British Museum. And you're a very prominent person. I'm sure you've had a conversation with George Osborne.
Not directly. I'd very much like to. Right. Yes, I communicate
with him. What would you say to him?
Funny enough, through a friend. I would say to him, because whenever the conversation about the what the British Museum often call the Elgin marbles, but
what
some
of us
call the Parthenon sculptures, because these are the huge sculptures that once lived on the Parthenon Temple in Athens, huge monumental things, a very different scale from the Cycladic figurine. What I would say and always say, because this is my knowledge of the Greeks and my understanding of their position, is that whenever there's any mention or use of the word loan, because the discussion always circulates around us lending back to Athens these sculptures, that that word loan will never, ever really feature in any proper conversation, because the Greeks, and in this particular conversation, I am Greek, they are not the British possession to loan. They do not truly belong to Britain. And this is because the British Museum bought stolen goods. Quite simply, Elgin wasn't given permission to remove the Parthenon sculptures. And that's the great sort of myth about it, that he was given permission by the Sultan, because Greece at that time was under the Ottoman Empire. So the story that most British people believe, and I did until I sort of bothered to read a bit more about it, was that he had the Sultan's permission to remove the sculptures and to bring them back for his own house in Scotland, which was his intention. Actually, what the surviving letter gives him permission to do is to take moulds, so, and to take artistic impressions so that they could be reproduced wherever he wanted to do that. Somehow, from that to what then happened, was he had for 2 years a team of people hacking these sculptures off with force, with hacksaws and crowbars. So they were physically prized off the front of the Parthenon temple. And some of them were broken in order to make them more transportable. And he took them by sea, put them on ships and brought them back to London. One of the ships sank on the way, so some of those sculptures sank to the bottom of the sea and divers had to be used to bring them up, and eventually they arrived back in London. So the idea that they actually belong to Elgin is very far from the truth. But when he got back, they never got as far as Scotland, to the house that he was wanting to kind of show off to his friends, because by that stage he was a bankrupt. His wife had left him for his best friend, and he had a very expensive divorce case to deal with, and he had no money. So the British government gave him £35,000.
That's a lot of money.
Well, it was a lot of money, but actually it covered his expenses. That was what the 35, it wasn't the nominal value of the sculptures. They were sort of bailing him out.
Right.
And the 35K, it sounds a lot, but he'd spent a vast amount on this huge undertaking to get these things from a massive height, get them down, 2 years' work, in his transport expenses. And then the British Museum had them to look after from then. So to me, the great myth that he was given permission and the way that he went about it, and the fact that the British Museum has always taken the line that they curate them, that they were safer, is, I won't use an impolite word, although I would if we weren't recording. It's complete nonsense.
It's bollocks, is that what you're saying?
Oh, Simon, I can't believe. Does that get bleeped? I'm glad you said it. It's an inaccuracy in every way. And I grew up, you know, with the idea, you know, I remember going as sort of 10 years old to the British Museum, and there they are in that grey, dreary Duveen Gallery, where they... curation is even a misnomer. You know, we the Duveen, who was an art collector, and he gave the money for the Duveen Gallery, which is why it's so named, and they were scrubbed, and they used wire wool to kind of clean them up. So we damaged the surface, you know, the British Museum damaged the surface of some of these great sculptures. Meanwhile, 14 years ago in Athens, the Acropolis Museum was opened, which is just the most beautiful museum in the world, with all these glass windows that look up towards the Acropolis, and you can see the Parthenon Temple from the window, where there's a place waiting to put these sculptures. But they will never accept a loan. And George Osborne, perhaps he does understand that, and he's playing some kind of diplomatic game. But the word loan is an insult to Greece and to the Greeks and to the Acropolis Museum, because you cannot loan something that you don't truly own.
Figurine is 500 pages. Was it always going to be... I mean, I would use the word epic, but was it always going to be 500 words, or did the story, as you were writing it, you thinking, oh, no, I need to expand here?
Yeah, no, I never know when I begin a book how long it needs to be. And I think books, certainly the ones I've written, are as long as they have to be. One I wrote, the last one I wrote, I think was only about 90,000 words, and this is around 150,000. So I don't think there's anything spare here. I'm very aware that paper costs have gone up, and publishers actually rather love shorter novels these days. So they didn't want to cut anything gratuitously. And actually, it became longer after my edits were given to me, because I was told that I did need to expand a bit here and there to explain more, rather than... I quite often do this thing when I'm writing, sort of assuming that my reader is sort of right with me, so they know something has happened that I haven't yet really explained fully.
Well, an edit that makes something longer is...
They often tell me to sort of expand a bit and not to make assumptions about what my readers know. For example, how, you know, the auction... There's an auction house scene in it, which I actually really enjoyed writing in the end, but I was asked to, you know, have that process really happening as though it's a kind of live scene in a film, and that was great fun to do. So no, I hope it's as long as it needs to be and no longer, because there's nothing worse than a reader feeling, oh, I'm just going to skip this bit. I don't think there are any bits that need to be skipped. I could write longer sex scenes, but I'm always told, don't write sex
scenes.
Well,
I notice your daughter is the first reader.
And she is indeed.
And is mentioned. I can't imagine anything about reading a sex scene written by your mother.
Yes, no, absolutely not. Your mother's never meant to have sex, let alone write about it.
I mean, it's not a lot of... Mind you, what is Helena thinking of? When Nick comes along, everyone goes, oh, he's no good. Because he's greedy and she... Anyway, you don't want to explain on that.
Yeah, but we're all... I mean, I think it's a life...
He's a badden is what I'm
saying. He's a badden, and every... I mean, I hope your children have done the same, but it's a rite of passage to not see something that everybody else in the world can see about a boyfriend or a girlfriend. You know, it's an if you go through life never making a mistake in love, you haven't really lived, have you?
Yeah, but
you?
There are mistakes in love, and then there's Nick.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying.
Love is blind, Simon.
If you would like to read more, Victoria Hislop's book is called The Figurine. There will be more with Victoria in a few days' time when the Q&A comes out. But for the moment, Victoria Hislop, thank you very much.
Thank you both.